Hello, may I welcome you to episode 83 of Moving Matters. I am your host, Colin Wynn. I hope Moving Matters will give you an insight to others working or have worked in this wonderful industry as I delve into their past, their present, and their future. You will find a new episode of Moving Matters on the second and fourth Thursday of each month. In this episode, we discuss how my guest began within the industry in 1967, which is when he bought his first vehicle that came with a starting handle. We discuss his challenges, what he would change from his moving past, his high points, what changes he would make to the industry, the advice he would give starting out again, his predictions for the next 5 years, and what he does outside of the workplace. And as always, we end Moving Matters with a funny moving story regarding a move to Spain. My guest this episode is Patrick McCrory, owner of McCrory's Removals. Enjoy. Good afternoon, Patrick. Welcome to Moving Matters. How are you today?
Very well, Colin. Thanks for inviting me. I've been looking forward to it.
You're very welcome. So can you tell everybody about yourself and the length of time within the industry?
Yes, it's a very long time. It's actually 19, I've had to think about this because I knew I was going to be speaking with you, and I had to work it out. Around 1967 was when I got my first vehicle.
Wow, that's the year before I was born.
Oh, there you are, you see. I'm actually 75 year old. In June.
Wow.
So I think it predated a Ford Transit, a Luton, and I think it was, I think it did have a starting handle.
Really?
Yeah.
The last person that told me that about a truck was David Trenchard when he was on the show.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know how David would be even a little bit older than me, I think. So that's when it was.
So how did you get started in the industry?
I actually moved to London as a teenager. As a family, the McCrory family moved to the northeast of England, up to Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And as soon as I could leave school, which was 15, 16, I moved to London on my own. And I worked a little bit in the... Actually, I did work for a company up in Middlesbrough for a little while. They were called carriers then. That word isn't used as much now.
No.
There were three brothers. Each of them drove a lorry. They looked as though they were pre-war, the lorries and the brothers. I'm sure one of them smoked a pipe. And they wore long brown coats, as people did in factories.
Yeah.
Very period, really, I suppose. There were open lorries, and there were lorries like the type of thing you would have, the army would have, with like a canvas tilt back on them.
Wow.
So they did move some furniture, but it was general carriers they were. So I was only like a van lad, helping and getting the paperwork ready and that sort of thing. So I've worked a little bit, I suppose. That was my first introduction to anything remotely transport related. But then... You know, I think I'm one of life's lucky people, Colin, because I think I really started driving a lorry when I was about 3 year old. Well, in my mind, and I should say I was brought up in County Tyrone in the mountains in Ireland, and without electricity, no water or television or telephone or anything like that. And the thing is, we didn't know we had no electricity. Nobody told us. Because nobody else did. So you're not deprived if you're the same as everyone else. You're not disadvantaged. But nowadays, in the same Sperrin Mountains, if you hadn't got broadband, I think you'd be deprived.
Wow.
That's how things have changed. But I used to find myself running along the lanes, and they weren't even tarred, most of these, the roads even. And I would pretend to be driving a lorry. And I was allowing for the length of it and the width of it around the corners. And I never scratched it or anything, you know, not once. I was even double declutching, you know. And I would never have seen vehicles are large. I must have seen one in a distant road or something, and it just. So I suppose you could say I have achieved what I dreamt of in a way. Not 100%, because, you know, the imagination of a child, you weren't just driving the lorry. You were the lorry.
Yeah, yeah.
So I haven't achieved that yet. I have to work at that one. So it was fated, I think. I had to be involved with lorries, I think. So I did a little bit of work in the grocery trade, and that's the only real job I did where I wasn't self-employed.
Right.
And I worked for a few years for a couple of different companies. This was before the times of self-service, and it was generally provisions. There was a counter called the provision counter. I think it might be the delicatessen counter now in supermarkets. So I would start with, a side of bacon and cut it up into all the different cuts.
Yeah.
So that was my speciality, really, bacon and cheese and that type of thing, cooked meats. And then in London, when I moved to London, I worked at a company called Safeway.
Yeah.
I think there was only two stores in the whole of Britain. An American company were very systemized. You know, they had a method, something called a method improvement plan. They had a manual. There was a proper way to sweep the floor. Do you know, I think that even the brush, you might call it a broom in England, the brush would probably have been on hire.
Really?
That was the impression I got, is that they leased everything. You know, they stuck to their core business.
Yeah.
And my job there, they'd send you for a couple of weeks training, and my job was shell filling. But you still had to go to this induction. And they paid a little bit more than the average supermarket. This was in Kensington High Street. And there would be two 40-foot lorries deliver every evening. And we could go home until they were emptied and put on the shop floor.
Wow.
So it was the hardest. I mean, I was young, fit and strong, but I fell asleep every morning on my way home in the short bus ride. I was that tired, because you would actually throw the cases to each other. And they call that spotting. So it'd come in pallets, and you'd throw a case of beans or peas or whatever. And if you happened to be standing in a row, like a chain gang, where the beans were, then you'd put it on the stack. If not, you threw it to the next person.
Wow.
And that was just the start, you know. So it really was. But Kensington High Street, Norman Wisdom lived in the mansion flats upstairs. And apparently he used to regularly complain about the noise we made. I think we might have played music. You know? he hadn't bargained for a supermarket being underneath, maybe. So the night shift allowed me to have daytime hours, and so I bought a van while I was down there, living in a bedsit, a small bedsit, sounds very grand, in Kensington Garden Square in Bayswater. So I didn't have far to go to the work, and I advertised in the Evening Standard. Now, the Evening Standard then, it was like, really, the circulation was like the equivalent of a national newspaper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It wasn't cheap, but so it was like move cheap, fast, now, or whatever, just four words or something. Yeah, you know? But I didn't have a telephone. Of course, there was no such thing as mobile phones. So I found a telephone answering service, which was a small newsagent on Park Lane. They had an invoice book, you know, a duplicate book that would be allocated for you. And when there would be a call, they would write down on a page, and they could tear that page out and give it to you. So they had a record of it. And you could phone them up, and they would give you the details either. But the great thing was that, and it wasn't wasted on me, I had a Mayfair phone number.
Oh, right. Yeah, imagine, yeah, yeah.
I may have had an old, decrepit Ford, what was it, a Ford Thames van, but I had a Mayfair telephone number.
Very prestigious area.
Imagine. So that wasn't wasted on me. I remember the first job I got was, it was an American consultancy office in Mayfair, and they had boardroom tables and all this gilt furniture and antiques and oil paintings. And Of course, I didn't have any stuff. I didn't have, I had a van. However, I did coax some of my colleagues who were working on the night shift in Safeway to come and help. And I ended up pricing the job, I can't remember what it was, you know, so much an hour, per man per hour. So the more staff that I recruited, the more profitable it was for me.
That was nice.
Yeah, so that was my baptism of fire, really. There's nothing like youth for having a nerve, really, is it?
So if you were doing night shifts at Safeway, removals during the day, when did you sleep, Patrick?
Yes, you found that actually you were only doing four nights a week.
Right.
So that helped. So you could try and work around that. You tried not to work if you needed to sleep. You know, you try and work on the days where you weren't at the night shift.
Incredible.
But I did get a couple of other jobs. I went round. Westbourne Grove was at the end of the street that I lived, and in Westbourne Grove there was an antique shop there that I went in and asked them if they had any work, delivery work. And it was a brass bed shop called Aristo Cat.
Nice.
And I used to deliver their brass beds for them a couple of afternoons a week. And the brass beds, I became quite knowledgeable at how to erect them. Some of them were four-poster beds. Some of them were what are called half-tester beds, which would only have like a little bit of an apron at the side. And I was delivering these into the Surrey stockbroker belt of London, you know, the thatched cottages and things like that. And some of these, the invoices would be like for £2,000 for a bed.
In those days, wow.
You could buy a wimpy home in the north of England, brand new, for £2,000. So that's like I was delivering beds, you might say, for £200,000, really.
Wow, incredible. How the other half live, eh?
I know. So that was my start.
So can you tell everybody about your company today and the services it offers?
Yes, I did actually after that. I ended up going into the antique trade.
Oh, wow.
Rather than removals for a period, for a number of years, in fact. And I ended up organising auctions in Ireland. Traded as McCrory and Conlon Fine Art Auctioneers.
Right.
And those were the days when there really was a hard border as well. But of course you needed a lorry. So my first lorry was when I was around 20, 21. It would have been after I was 21 year old because I got my heavy goods license. And then as soon as I had that, I got my first lorry. And you needed a lorry to do the auctions in Ireland. Very complicated. It was during the times of the Troubles as well.
Yeah.
We used to actually hold the auctions in the north of Ireland initially. Curiously, people would travel from all over the place, even during those times, and they were even in auctions. But it's strange, really. It was very cross-community. They all knew each other, the antique trade, but they seemed to correspond. You know, they only met at auctions.
Right.
But there was no animosity. We sold everything. We've sold at different times maybe portraits of the monarch or of the pontiff,
yeah,
without making any remarks. And it was interesting. It was a good apprenticeship for the removal trade because you really had to carefully pack everything and utilize all the space. I mean, we would put chairs inside of wardrobes and then we'd put boxes inside the chairs.
Yeah.
We could take a couple of months to fill a lorry, a big lorry, but we could get 1,700 lots in there. It was definitely good practice. And there were no mobile phones with cameras then. Otherwise, we'd have some wonderful photographs for our website where, you know, you were carrying maybe porcelain figurines under glass domes and getting them there without any air suspension or anything then.
So when you were doing the antiques, were you then taking the antiques from the UK over to Ireland?
Yes, buying them in auctions and organising our own auction in Ireland, yeah.
Right.
So after a period of doing that, I fulfilled, a lifetime's dream to cross the Sahara Desert, and I didn't know that I'd always wanted to do it. But we used to get missionaries would come in Ireland and they would talk about their travels in Africa every couple of years. And this was better than going to the cinema. Well, we never went. Cinema was too far away. And they were good at storytelling. I suppose it was meant to instill some kind of morals, but they were good. And I don't know if they did anything for the morals, but I think I'd be looking. Imagine how impressionable you are without television or anything. And you'd be looking at these people and you could see that they were revered. And apart from the swallows, this was the only thing I could see that went to a land where there was oranges growing and came back again. And that must have sown that seed of, I would like to see. I couldn't have imagined that I would ever have seen such a land.
Yeah.
And eventually I read quite a lot of accounts of people who did cross the desert and the various means that they used. And the most interesting ones were the ones that went almost fatally wrong, in fact. Of course, they didn't go wrong entirely fatally because there's an account of them there. But so instead of being a dream, as it grew closer to actually departing, it was a potential nightmare. I realized that it could be dangerous. And of course, I couldn't, if things went wrong, I couldn't rely on saying that I knew Mrs. Thatcher. As her son did when he got lost in the desert.
Very good, very good.
So after I moved to Nottingham about 40 years ago, I had lived with my partner, Ian Conlon, who we traded McCrory and Conlon, Fine Art Auctioneers.
Yeah.
Then dissolved that partnership and left and came down to Nottingham, lived down here. I wanted to get far enough away from the northeast so I wouldn't be treading on anyone's toes. The auctions were different auctions down here. And eventually I met my current partner more than 30 years ago, who is Joe McKevitt, became Joe McCrory about 5 years ago.
Oh, good.
6 years ago, in fact.
Good on you.
It took 32 years to finally propose as a surprise at his 50th, in fact. He's 20 years younger than me.
Right, yeah.
Joe has been a bus driver for more than 20 years, and he actually got sick of the bus driving, and he was so sick of it that he agreed to join me with the furniture removal and took a heavy goods driving test as well.
Yeah.
That's how much he hated the bus driving. Not how much he wanted to do removals.
Surely it's easier to drive a bus than it is to do removals.
You would think that, but I think he'd had enough. They're a great bunch of lads that he worked with, 600 people in Nottingham City Transport, and I can't go downtown without everyone knowing where I've been because they all know me. I don't know all them. It's like living in a village, really. But it was interesting, as I say, because it was a different era, really. And as I mentioned at the wedding, that when we first met, we were criminals because they had only just, I think they'd only decriminalized being what used to be called a practicing homosexual. that would usually be some kind of story in a Sunday paper, you know, somebody was accused of being a practicing homosexual. I think we've got past the practicing stage now. We're getting quite perfect, I think. So, yeah, a different era. But I've always found being gay irrelevant, really. In fact, I've not ever, I'm telling you that now because it is irrelevant, but it's not something I've ever said to anybody, is that I am gay. Because why would you? You know, I think things have changed so much now that I could imagine me asking some of my straight mates, when did you first realize that you were straight?
Yeah, that's a fair point.
You know, that's how irrelevant it is now.
It is totally irrelevant today.
Yeah.
Totally irrelevant. So going back to McCrory's.
Yeah.
What services do you offer today?
Really, it's specialised in UK, Ireland, in both directions. So we really do specialise. The name McCrory's, I mean, we did do some work in Nottingham, the local area. We did some in the northeast of England originally as well. But we found that I think the more that any business can differentiate themselves, the better.
Yeah.
To try and survive. And if you can differentiate yourself from not just having vans, but having lorries, and if you can have the bigger lorries, like we have demountable with drawbar trailers, so you can take on any job, really.
Yeah.
No matter how big it is. And then the more distant you do, then you're not competing with just anybody. You need an international operator's license. And then we would get people, I'm sure, who would want us, repeat customers, when people moved a few years down the line. But in England, they might become dyslexic with the name McCrory. It's a little bit difficult for them. So it's not a selling point. Whereas in Ireland, you know, when somebody contacts you, it's almost a conversation. They'll ask you, are you from Donegal? Because they know where the name's from, you know, and it is Irish.
Yep.
You know, so it's actually it's an advantage. I had a conversation with Paul Fox at a social gathering a few years ago. And one of the first things Paul asked me, of course, was, I hear you do removals, Patrick. You know what the next question would be?
Go on.
Are you in the bar?
Good old Paul. I like Paul. Good old Paul. Get in there.
It's like a religion, isn't it? And his father before him.
Yeah, Roy. Yeah.
But I'd explain to Paul. Now, you know, Paul, we specialise in UK Ireland removals. The bar, and I can see the advantages of it, and I do respect it and admire it. But, you know, if you're paying for the membership, you're going to have all over your vehicles, your letterhead, your website, BAR member. I've thought of, Paul, having my own spurious one, just inventing one. It would be maybe the Irish Removers Association. And you can imagine.
That would not go down very well.
Imagine member and then having an Irish voice on the phone saying, are you sure you don't want to move? We've got your address. I remember I asked Paul a question out of interest, because I know they're very into training, and because they had different companies. So they used to do a video, in fact. His sister approached me when she was working with Paul to try and source a grand piano, because they wanted to do a video, so they would all be working from the same hymn sheet, the different companies that they'd bought. And I remember asking Paul, you know, if a customer was deciding to pick one company rather than another, say they were deciding on Holtz or Pickfords or Foxes, what one word would you say would sum up the criteria? And he got a word that I think I would have agreed with. Well, wasn't the word I always think is appropriate? And eventually I had to tell him what I think that one word is that really clinches it. And that is, all else being equal, that word is confidence.
Right, yeah.
And he didn't hesitate for too long. He said, yes, when I go in on Monday morning, and he put his fist in the air and he said, it's going to be confidence! So he agreed. But if you, as I said to Paul, if somebody phones me and they ask me for a quote for moving to Dunleary, if I have to ask them, how do you spell Dunleary, I've lost it. Whereas if I start a conversation like, what do you think of the sculptures on the seafront at Dunleary? Or do you ever use the farmer's market there? You have a far better chance of getting the confidence of the customer on the phone initially, because they might think you might have been there before.
Yeah.
Confidence. all else being equal, I think it makes an awful difference, I think, if you can relate, and specialising does help in that case.
So how many vehicles are you running then, Patrick?
We now are down to, this is a matter of pride, the less the better, and we've 2 18-ton HGVs, demountable.
Yeah.
2 3.5-ton vans, and an 18-ton demountable trailer, and a 3.5-ton box trailer.
And how many demountables do you have then?
About 5 right. bodies we have.
Yeah.
So we're very wedded to demountables.
And are you doing storage as well?
No. No, we don't do storage unless it's in transit. So it's unless it's our customers that we're going to move them and they need storage. But the wonderful thing about demountable, if we're moving them on,
yeah,
is that if there's unexpected storage or very short term, we're not tying up a lorry. We can just accumulate it in our yard.
Yeah.
And I explained to the customers that being demountable means that it has to have, it looks like an ordinary lorry, but it's got 4 legs, but it has to have suspension all around to raise it and lower it. And that means that you can tell your family and friends that your removal was delivered by air. No, you can imagine.
I like it.
You can imagine, Colin, I've said that a few times.
Yeah, I've gathered that one.
Yeah.
I like that. So what challenges have you had to overcome then, Patrick?
Oh, only a few.
Well, you're fairly new to the industry, don't forget.
Yes. Yeah, that's... I think one of the worst ones, and in fact, I would say without any doubt, the worst decision I ever made was to not consider the implications of signing a contract to join a certain trade association. And it turned out to not work out very well. I've found out since that I'm not alone, and I don't think they were very bona fide, and they've been revealed as such, I think. So that was an awful experience, but we came through it. I wouldn't make the same mistake again, but I do read contracts a little bit more carefully now. But I think staff will always be a challenge.
Yes.
If you think about it, it's quite something to recruit someone that is both young enough to be healthy and strong and to be able to lift furniture, and yet to be old enough to have already reared a family and have settled down and be reliable. You know, there's an awful, it's a big ask. I think really we're buying and selling labour, really.
Yeah.
And to be able to motivate staff to do what is really hard physical work, and to want to do it in a customer pleasing way, under pressure often, and during irregular hours, and often be away from home and not always comfortably. It is an awful big ask, and I think that will always be a challenge for everyone.
It's the irregular hours that gets me, because you never know when you're going to finish.
Yes, it's hard for someone to come from a conventional job.
Yeah, a 9-to-5, and all of a sudden you're starting at 7, but you may not be finished at 3. You may be still out there at 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah. But the other thing that we have to consider is I think that drivers in particular, there's the fact that they have all the responsibility of keeping hold of a heavy goods license.
Yeah.
And all the hazards that are out there that could be implicated very easily. They could lose the license at the drop of a hat, really. And their health as well. Think of how many people of even quite a young age end up having to take medication for blood pressure.
Yeah.
That doesn't affect you on most jobs, but it does when you drive a lorry.
Yeah.
You can lose your livelihoods. So I think they're still underrated. Even though the wages have gone up, they're still underrated.
Interesting. Interesting observation. So if you could change anything from your moving past, Patrick, what would it be?
Well, I sometimes boast, Colin, that I can speak three languages fluently, but I can't say no in any of them. I wished I had sometimes learned to say that word. Yes has occasionally put me under more pressure than I really enjoy. So that's what I would change.
But isn't it a case in this industry, though, that when you go out and you see a potential job, all you want to do is help them? It is pretty damn difficult to say no.
It's difficult to say no, but it's because I think it's the hungry child. You really don't try unless you have struggled, I think. And if you've struggled to pay your bills or you're worried that you might not be able to pay, that's why I think it's harder to say no, really. Yes, you do want to oblige people, but I think it's after you've said yes that there's no going back. There's no such thing. You just know that it doesn't matter what happens after that. It doesn't matter if the lorry breaks down or it doesn't matter if the staff don't turn up. You still are obliged. The buck stops here. The customer doesn't want to know any of that, and they shouldn't want to know. As I said, if I would change it from the past, I would make sure that I could do it comfortably before I said yes.
So what is your high point of being within the industry?
Well, there has been a lot, really. Apart from seeing a certain individual getting filmed outside of a courthouse and being foul-mouthed, that was quite a high point. That was Christmas come early for me. It showed the real nature of the animal. But apart from that, I think getting and using my first demountable drawbar trailer and actually using it, seeing it being used, was quite an achievement. I felt a sense of achievement. I wasn't just a lorry then, I was a trailer as well.
When did you change to demountables?
I would think it would have been... I've never used what you call lift vans, I think, isn't it? The boxes.
Yeah.
Although I have had a side door lorry before.
Yeah.
The thing is, with the part loads going to Ireland,
Yeah.
You really would lose an awful lot of space if you didn't load them loose. And if you think about it, with a demountable, it could take whatever, 30 man hours to load and pack it. But if you want to swap bodies, it takes one man 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I've just sold you a demountable lorry.
Well, I'm amazed at the number of people that don't use demountables in the industry, having spoken to several people that do these days.
Yeah, the shortage of drivers should make people think even more of the advantages of a demountable. Because you have in effect got as many, you've half a dozen lorries for one, but you're not necessarily tying a driver up all the time.
Yeah.
That it's being manually loaded or unloaded.
Yeah.
And then there's the amount of space that you've got. You can have a bad access for a impossible access for an articulated lorry, which is the next biggest item you could get from a 18-ton rigid. But with an 18-ton rigid that's demountable and a trailer behind that's the same size, you've got 3,500 cubic feet.
Yeah.
And you don't have to take the whole thing to park it at the house. You can take the lorry in, then go back, do a swap and take the other body in.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you don't have the boxes. You can have side doors on a demountable if you want it.
Yeah, I was wondering that.
I've seen Dales. They do France a lot. They have everything, really, if you think about it. They have demountable, but they also... They have some kind of I think they've designed it themselves. They have side doors and they have if you can think of a reinforcement for concrete, like a cage thing that goes, I think I've seen one that even had a curtain side, but they have this reinforcement that is in front of the curtain, and that can swivel round and separate the loads as well if you want it inside the lorry.
Yeah.
So that's like having the best of both worlds, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What one thing would you change within the moving industry then, Patrick?
Change? I actually employed a young man from Siberia some years ago.
Right.
Before there was the influx of Eastern Europeans, his wife came to Nottingham as a nurse, and she found him the job with McCrory's Removals. He couldn't speak very good English. He could speak Russian. Sometimes our customers will ask us, do we wrap the furniture? And I would tell them about this Andre from Siberia, that he confessed to me that for his first couple of hours working on the lorry, he wasn't sure what our business was. He didn't understand the concept of moving a house, maybe. And he confessed to me that he thought our business was blanket merchants.
Really?
We had that many blankets stacked at the back of the lorry, you know. So instead of me just telling the customer, yes, we do wrap the furniture, I tell them about Andre. If I could change things, it might be to try and insist that everyone who works within the removal business would get an opportunity on a reasonably regular basis, no matter what their job is in the office or who they are or how senior they are, that they would get an opportunity to go and work on the lorry, meet the customers and try and help the driver and the porter and see what they do and see what their real business is. And it's not really just moving papers around the desk. And they would appreciate that maybe what the drivers and porters, what a linchpin they are to the business.
Yeah, and I think it also works the other way as well, in that the porters and the drivers should come and sit in the office for a day or two and see what the admin staff have to deal with on a daily basis.
Exactly, and try and see how hard they work at getting the work in the first place.
I think it's a good idea. I think it's a very good idea. People should know about the variety of roles within a business.
Yeah,
they don't need to be an expert at it, but they just need to have an understanding of it.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So what advice would you give yourself just starting out in the industry again?
I think it was just starting. Instead of just fretting about only owning a small van, a Luton van, fretting about the fact that it's not a lorry for the first year or two, as I had to, I might be grateful for the invaluable experience of having to utilize every inch of space.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't fret now. I'd appreciate it. But of course, you can only do that with hindsight.
And a lot of companies today are using smaller vehicles.
Yes. I can never feel snobbish or condemn man and van just because they're smaller vehicles, provided they're not being reckless or they're not overloading dangerously or so on. But the reality is that if it's a long-distance job, there isn't an option, really, of doing two journeys.
Yeah.
So they have to utilize the space, and it's good training for them. And one day, you know, some of those man and van will be heavy goods operators, I'm sure, because it'll pay them to.
Yeah. I think all man and van operators, when they turn into man and several vans, will at some point get a truck. And then after the truck comes their own warehouse, and before you know it, they have a variety of vehicles.
The removal business as well, it's not like a normal self-employed tradesman. From day one, you have to employ a second person.
Yeah.
A plumber doesn't have to do that.
Correct.
An electrician. So it's already a leap from day one.
So where do you see yourself in the industry in the next 5 years?
Well, in five... I've,
you're going to put your feet up, Patrick.
I promised that I'm supposed to be there. I think I retired about 2 years ago. And Colin, I've enjoyed it that much. I might do it again sometime. But I have said that... I'm 75 in June, on the 4th of June. So on the 5th of June, I can actually say that I'm I'm nearer 80 than 70. So I definitely won't be carrying too much heavy furniture, I don't think.
I would hope not.
Not in 5 years' time. Customers often comment when they see me working on the van, in fact, and I feel compelled to say to them quite often, I'm not doing bad for a 28-year-old, am I? Which they often do compliment. I don't know if they're sincere or not, but they say, no, you look good for you. And I would then often say, yeah, but you want to see me on a good day. But I'll tell you that the best response I had was from somebody called Shane Connaughton. I'd never heard of him, but it turns out he is a very famous playwright. And when I said to him, while I was unloading some of his lots of boxes of books to his second home in Ireland, I'm not doing bad for a 28-year-old, am I, Shane? And he looked at me and he said, you don't look it, Patrick. Well, I suppose you'd expect nothing less from a playwright. And I thought, what a fabulous answer. But realistically, I will soon have to retire. And I have now actively started trying to sell McCrory's Removals Limited as a going concern. It is an ideal bolt-on business to be added to any existing removal business because it can be relocated to anywhere. And it has got really a lot of goodwill value because of the length of time we've been at it. But anyone living anywhere within the UK or Ireland, if they search for Removals UK Ireland or any similar terms, because we've been at it so long and they've never heard of McCrory's, they should find that we are at the top of page one on Google, and that's organically, which is quite an achievement, really.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know, if you think of all the much larger companies.
Yeah.
That's excluding the advertised listings and the non-removal companies, the comparison sites and the bedroom brokers and all that sort of thing. But real removal companies, we would be at the top. And as I said, there's a lot of goodwill after a lifetime of building the business up. And the Irish removal market really is it's a very valuable niche, and it'll always be valuable because since Brexit, it's now the only English-speaking country within the EU.
Yeah, yeah.
So any multinational wanting a presence within the EU, they really have to consider Ireland. And at the minute, apparently, there's over 1,000 of these foreign giants have put their head office in Ireland. Names like Apple, Google, Microsoft, yeah, yeah. PayPal, yeah. All of them, they feel they have to be in Ireland if they're going to be in the EU. So there will always be that high-dem relocation business, plus the fact that there's the long-established diaspora. Apparently there's about 6 million people who have got grandparents that were born in Ireland.
Right.
And even though they might have grandchildren here, and they're well established, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, but we have heard it. If they meet in the street, they can still be heard to say to each other, are you going home for Christmas? So it will always be home. In fact, we once had one of our lorries used to say, McCrory's Removals, taking people home for 40 years.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Now imagine with a shamrock and the Celtic lettering, yeah. And the name. If they see that in the street in London,
yeah, yeah.
They just know they have the right number.
Yeah, brilliant.
So it'll always be home, I think. But in the old days, apparently, when you had people emigrating from Ireland, it was almost treated like a bereavement.
Really?
Yeah, they would hold a leaving party, which was more like a wake.
Because
they all knew that very often they would never afford to return. They would never see them again. They would even light a bonfire on the coast so that as they sailed away, there'd be the last sight of Ireland, the last thing they would see.
Oh, wow.
So it was a big event, whereas now it's, you know, they can fly back and forward the same day now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some do. Some will actually fly out from Ireland to meet us at an address in Birmingham or London, let us in, and then fly back home.
Yeah, I can believe it.
It's very, very different, really, how things have changed. But of course, Ryanair wasn't invented during the sailing boat times, you know. It was a bigger event, but if we do any job for any length of time, it becomes routine. You know, if you're getting a phone call, it's a pretty regular sort of usual questions like, is that the removal company, or can you give me an estimate?
Yeah.
But not since Brexit.
Interesting.
Since Brexit, it's more likely to be, are you still doing removals to Ireland? And I've realised why that is. If they live in Kent or Surrey or wherever, and they've moved a few times during their lifetime, they'll get a local company to move them locally within the UK. And then they've decided they're going to go back to Ireland. They will get the same company. And in the past, that would work fine. But since Brexit, they're obviously coming up against people saying, oh no, we don't do Ireland anymore.
Yeah.
Because of the customs, and it's not familiar to them anymore. And there's that fear of the unknown, I think. So it means that there's less competition for us, because we haven't got all the UK companies doing it now. And I think that's another selling point, really. There always will be that demand. And for a company as small as ours to have access to that, if we're honest, we wouldn't get inquiries for the equivalent level of value of a job as often as we do, except that it's a niche.
Yeah.
And the competition isn't there, really. So, yes, I'm afraid I will definitely have to sell it, because much as I enjoy it, it's part of your life, really.
Almost definitely.
So I want to sell it as a thriving going concern. I don't want to run it down. Another thing I've often heard said is that it's always been the case that rich people spend money to save time, and poor people spend time to save money. Now, if somebody has a little bit of money, not an awful lot, they could save decades of building up a very valuable business by buying McCrory's.
Well, I'm sure if there's anyone interested out there, Patrick, your details will be on our webpage.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you in the market then, Colin?
For buying a removal company? Yeah. No. I'm going to stick with IT, I'm afraid.
And I thought it was a good salesman.
You're very good, Patrick. You are very good. But I'm sure somebody will reach out to you.
Well, I'd like to see it go to a good home.
Yeah.
But I think the moving industry will certainly see changes. I think there'll be more regulations. I think there'll be regulations that we haven't thought of yet, such as the amount of maximum weight that a person can lift.
Interesting.
I think there is a trend of minimalism as well.
Yeah.
Young people don't want the clutter the rest of us might want. And there'll be more kit and disposable furniture. And I could imagine they could even get to the stage that there could be prefabricated. I think they already exist. So you could have an IKEA number 37.
Yeah.
And it'll just be identical. You don't need to move anything then, maybe. But I've often wondered why all filling stations ended up being self-service. Is it just on economic grounds? Is it really innocent? And why supermarkets are going into so much
self-service
at the till. If you look at a till operator and they're sat there in that position and they're swiveling right to left and lifting them along a conveyor belt, eventually there's going to be what you might call facetiously the repetitive claim industry getting a hand in there. Those people are moving tons, and they're moving them in a bad way.
Yeah.
They're seated and they're swiveling round. I wonder whether the supermarkets can see what's coming along the line, is that there will be claims. And I don't know, but I have an awful feeling that, you know, I've still got two knees, but, you know, one of them isn't as good as it used to be. And I live in an Edwardian house, but the stairs are unusually steep. I've only this last year got a downstairs bathroom, because I keep saying the day will come when I can't carry Joe up the stairs.
Ah, dear.
So, you know, it does take its toll. And I just wonder whether, I know that people are listening to your podcast, as I have numerous, almost invariably you will hear everyone crying out for more regulation. More regulation on the 3.5 tons.
Yeah.
It's like how everyone complains if they see a traffic warden. Everyone wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Yeah. We all want a parking space, but the regulation is for the other people. It's the others. So I can see regulation coming in that we might not welcome, because it could threaten our very existence. You know, there's already, if you look at some boxes, you'll see printed on 2-man lift.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of us, we ignore it.
And fill to this line.
Yes, yeah. I think that's in the pipeline.
That's an interesting one.
And I think it's a threat.
Very interesting. So what do you do outside of the industry to switch off then, Patrick?
Well, I do like to travel. I've got myself a camper van. And I like to make bread. I've actually experienced making bread in the desert. I combine them both. I like making bread in the camper van as well, whilst on the move. But it's soda bread. It's not a lockdown thing. It's something I've done all my life, really. I do like cookery as well, but I like gardening, reading, and listening to the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm addicted to Radio 4. I could tell you what time of day it is by what's on Radio 4. As long as it's not the Archers.
My days of radio ended several years ago, and then it just went straight to Spotify.
Well, no, I'm still addicted to it.
So it's full of music, but it's more Spotify than radio.
Well, I remember the BBC doing a bit of cross-promoting Radio 4. They were promoting, and it showed you somebody arriving in a car at an office block, and they're sat in the car, and they kept looking at their watch. And they're still sat in the car, and they keep looking at the watch. And then eventually the caption was, "Sometimes the journey just isn't long enough." That sums it up, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I like to end my podcast with a funny moving story. Do you have one or more to tell?
How many episodes have you got? I've thought about this. Now, there is one that it might be a little bit long, but I'll try not to give you a scenic version of it. It was the one I'm thinking of was, Joe actually came along to that one. Joe wasn't he wasn't involved with removals, but the minute you mention Italy or Spain, suddenly everybody wants to do removal.
Of course.
And we did actually used to sell tea chests.
Oh, my word. That's a bit of equipment that goes back a bit.
I've got the scars to show it.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, the metal, the brilliant things. You could stand on them. But and in selling tea chests, we were tea chest merchants as well as removals. We actually had one lorry. We had the roof reinforced. It was an old Bedford lorry, and a gallery put on the roof.
Oh, wow.
So we could have tea chests on the roof.
On the roof.
As well as inside. And you got certain sizes. There was square ones that were larger than another size. So you could put one inside the other. The tail lift at the tea factory would lift them up on the roof for us. And when we delivered enough from inside, we'd climb up on the roof and then throw them down and use the roof as well.
Wow.
It wasn't uncommon at one time for vehicles and buses to carry goods on the roof, believe it or not, but that's a long time ago since that happened. Health and safety wouldn't approve of it now.
Oh, definitely not. No. Definitely not.
But this particular lady bought some tea chests from us in an area of Nottingham, Langer, a little village. And I asked her, as I would ask all of them, you know, are you moving anywhere exotic? And of course, I'm just selling her tea chests. And said, yes, she's going to Spain. And I said, oh, I wonder, could we quote for your removal? She said, yes, of course you can. So I did quote and I got the job. And it turned out that she wanted to travel in the lorry.
Okay.
And she had a big dog, a bull mastiff dog as well. And now there's no sleeper cab in this lorry. It was a Ford. So there's me, Joe, the bull mastiff, and Christine. And Christine, she was quite glamorous. She actually, we picked some stuff up from her son-in-law's, and they were obviously reasonably well off. There was lots of prestige cars parked about the place, a swimming pool. There was even furniture we had to collect from round the swimming pool and put it on the lorry. And I remember this son-in-law who looked at our lorry and said, that effing yoke won't make it to Spain, or something like that. I said, well, we'll be fine once we get a bit of stuff on the roof. We'll be okay, you know. That wasn't the roof rack one. But he sort of was all right then, really. But anyway, we started the journey. We didn't get very far down the road to the A1. And Christine, she apologized about her son-in-law, who might be a bit foul-mouthed. She said that, you don't know what he said to me, but he said, you know, you'll have shagged both those feckers by the time you get...
Oh, dear.
Now, the thing is, Christine then goes on to tell us about her favourite film. Now, she's good-hearted. She's quite glamorous. She's actually wearing this, like a leopard skin coat. And I don't know why, but I was suffering from... For the first time in my life, I started suffering from backache that I never had before, and maybe a draft. And she ended up putting this coat round my shoulders, you know. She's mothering me, maybe. Anyway, she showed photographs of the daughters. Both the daughters had done modelling.
Right.
Draped over cars at motor shows,
yeah,
type
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
So you could see where they got the looks from, but Christine had poise. So there's the three of us. The first and first night we get to this Formula One in France, where I don't know if you've ever known these motels where you can check in with a card and, you know, nobody knows who's in there. So there's the three of us and a dog, a big dog. And the layout of these is that there's a double bed, and above the double bed there's a bunk bed. Arched over it with steps. So Christine gets in the bunk bed above, and Joe and me gets in the double bed. That's fine. Next night, exactly the same layout, but as soon as we get inside the door, Christine pipes up and says, well, I should tell you, her favourite film is Shirley Valentine. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
Well, Christine herself is actually getting away from a bad marriage.
Right.
And she's really moving, partly because her son has got leukemia or something. She wants to really try and see that he has a little bit of quality of life for as long as he's going to live. It's a terminal illness. So she's good-hearted. So, Shirley Valentine, remember, my favourite line from that film, if you remember it, is she is propositioned if she wants to come on the fishing boat of the hotelier. Do you remember?
Yeah.
And she says to him, no, she said, you just want to shag me. And his response is, no, boat is boat and feck is feck. Remember? Yeah, that's his line. Boat is boat. So anyway, we get to the second night, and as soon as we open the motel door, Christine says, I'm not sleeping in that thing. Last night, my knees kept touching the bloody ceiling. So Joe pipes up and says, oh, it's all right, I'll sleep up there. So that leaves the double bed. Now, I don't actually wear pajamas even at home, you know. And the thing is, I've told a lot of people this, and the first question they ask is, well, Patrick, well? And do you know what my response is? Do you know what my response is, Colin?
Go for it.
Sport is sport.
Very good, very good.
When we got down finally to meet her other daughter, who was already near Marbella, she treated us to a meal, in fact, Christine. I should say that on the journey, no mobile phones, she took us 5 days to get there.
Oh, wow.
And we've never been accused of being fast, but she got through on the phone. I helped her, a coin phone, and it ended up being an answer phone. And she said, hello, darling, it's your mother here. Don't worry about me. Speak soon. Bye. I said, Christine, that was everything but a ransom note. It sounded terrible. But now, the daughter was gorgeous as well. And really, you could see a wonderful relationship. There was a bit of a story even in the end. I cooked Christine a meal, I remember. And we stayed overnight at her place. And would you believe, I'd put an advert in the paper. There's an English language paper in Spain. And we got a return load.
Really?
To Gateshead, yes, which is incredible, really. From the same area. And I'd contacted them saying, yeah, we're here now and we can come tomorrow. And the only question that the customer who was moving to Gateshead, the only question I asked is, can you take my two cats? You know, as well as the furniture, but I said, no, I cannot. You know, there's controls over animals. We can't do that. And then she just said, oh, okay then. And I thought, well, that was strange. It didn't seem to make any fuss about it. And I told Christine, now I've got this other job. I've got to go now. And Christine said to us, oh, go on now. You've got this other woman that you're going to go and see. I said, Christine, I can assure you, I have a suspicion about this lady. I have, and if she, I just have an awful suspicion that if she tells us to keep putting milk in a box, there's something wrong. So I will insist I won't have anything to do with that other lady customer, Christine, until I have first seen her pussy. When we got to the,
oh dear,
the Gateshead job, it was boarded up. There was nobody there.
Really?
So they'd gone. Maybe hadn't paid the rent or whatever, I don't know. So probably a lucky escape, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyone who tells you that removals is boring, Colin, they haven't done it.
I've never been told that removals is boring.
No, I can't.
And I hope to never be told that. Too much fun in removals. Well, Patrick, many thanks for giving up your time to record this episode of Moving Matters with me. I truly appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it, Colin. I hope I haven't been too talkative.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I thank you very much. I sincerely hope you enjoyed episode 83 of Moving Matters. Please rate, review, and subscribe in your favourite podcast player of choice, and please tell your industry colleagues about Moving Matters. My thanks and appreciation go to Patrick McCrory of McCrory's Removals for giving up his time to record this episode. Thank you again, Patrick. If you would like to know more about McCrory's Removals and the services they provide, then you will find links within the show notes for this episode and on our webpage, movingmatterspodcast.co.uk. And don't forget, Patrick is actively looking to sell his business, so do get in touch. And please, if you have a funny moving story that can be relayed to our listeners, or you would like to be a guest on the podcast, then do reach out to me by completing the contact form on our webpage, movingmatterspodcast.co.uk. Well, that is all from me, so until next time, keep moving.